of cluster physics on Yersinia salvage effect. And I'd like to sort of touch base on small scale, so cluster bubbles, up to cosmological parameters. All right, so that's the plan of the talk. I'm going to start with trying to introduce to you the cluster gastro physics, so building upon Daisuke's talk and sort of looking at the cosmic ray population that is accelerated at shocks and at its imprint on the Yersinia-Seldovich effects. Moving in the second part on to the cluster cosmology, trying to assess the role of the cosmic ray pressure on the scaling relations, as well as the radiative physics, how this will potentially bias cosmological parameters. And then in the last part of this cosmological part, I'd like to turn to hydrostatic cluster masses, which are intimately related to the total compromise parameter. And then the last part, I'd like to sort of go to small scales, which is not quite a topic of this talk, but I found quite cute because this is definitely, in my opinion, one of the sort of roads of the future of Yersinia-Seldovich observations going on small scales. And the Yersinia-Seldovich effect, I will sort of make a proposal how this will be able to unveil the bubble composition of these AGN bubbles. And then close with a few simulations of AGN feedback in a cosmological environment. All right, so shocks and galaxy clusters, we know that they are there. They are very rarely seen, however, in the X-rays. On the left side, you see the poster child of a shock in a galaxy cluster, the bullet cluster, and you can see a clear signature of a contact discontinuity that is sort of trailing behind a shock that can't be seen in its coral scale. So there are only two examples of a shock that you can see directly in the X-ray images, and I will explain to you in further reminder of the talk why this is the case. On the right-hand side, you can see an indirect example of a shock. So if a cluster merges, there are two shock waves basically sent off, a forward and a backward shock that travel and steepen as they come into the outside, into the shallow cluster potential. These shocks amplify magnetic fields, accelerate cosmic ray electrons, and they emit singleton, radio singleton emission on megaparsec sizes. So the reason why we do observe this diffuse radio emission here is a direct evidence of a shock accelerated populations of electrons. All right. So what are the sort of questions I'm going to ask myself and try to touch upon in my talk? How does cluster physics, cooling, star formation, turbulence, cosmic rays, and AGN feedback impact on the thermal pressure distribution? How are the S-set scaling relations and hydrostatic masses biased? And in sort of passing by, I'd like to sort of mention a very peculiar thing that I ran by last week. And do we understand really our numerical methods well enough to trust these answers? The second big question is, how does this propagate into the uncertainties of cosmological parameters, in particular on omega 8 and W, and possibly bias their mean? And last but not least, how can actually the Yersinia-Seldovich effect help in solving the cooling flow problem and shape our understanding of cluster evolution? All right, so here's the cartoon version of what our simulations do. structure formation grows hierarchically. Gravitational energy is dissipated by means of structure formation shocks into thermal energy. In the densest parts, it cools radiatively, forms stars. These stars go supernovae and re-inject energy into the thermal reservoir. How can we observe the thermal energy? Well, by means of the X-ray emission that's associated with the radiative cooling, and by means of the Yersinia-Seldovich effect. How do cosmic rays fit into this picture? Well, we know that shocks on small scales and supernova remnants accelerate cosmic rays. This is this arrow. And we have direct evidence that shocks also accelerate cosmic ray electrons, and implying that a shock is a fundamental plasma physical process, we believe that shocks also accelerate cosmic ray protons. So that means we actually have to find our shocks in the simulations, measure the Mach numbers for the shock strength, and inject the amount of cosmic rays accordingly in the simulations. These cosmic rays then are being transported along as the structure grows. They cool by means of Coulomb collisions with the surrounding electrons. They lose energy, basically, it's transferred to the electrons. And they can actually, once in Hubble time, on average, actually collide inelastically with the ambient gas protons. And this is shown here. On average, once a Hubble time, a cosmic ray proton collides inelastically, produces pions. If these are positively charged, they will decay into electrons and positrons that can emit singleton emission in the magnetic fields, or Compton upscatter the CMB photons into the hard X-ray and gamma ray regime. So that's a direct observable of these protons, the radio emission that it produces. If these pions are neutral, it will decay directly into gamma rays and emit into in the regime where Fermi is observing now the all of our sky, basically, and at very high energies by imaging at range of telescopes. So I'm not going to touch upon these non-thermal processes, even though they're very interesting, since I'm going to ask the questions, how is this cosmic ray energy actually affecting the thermal energy by means of its pressure support, and how this is then basically impacting on the thermal observables that you can actually derive from this, or that's a bit derived from this. One very important thing are AGN. They seem to be the key to understand cool core clusters. And then the last part, I'm going to show you a few cosmological simulations where we actually put cosmic ray feedback injected by AGN and address basically what effect they have. All right. So similar to Daisuke, basically, we first run a big cosmological box simulations, identified the halos that we wanted, that we've been interested in. This was a dark matter only simulation. We then repopulated the region that formed the cluster at very high redshift 50 with smaller masses with much more particles, and then we sort of did the simulation evolve, you know, let the simulation evolve forward in time. So that's the gas density distribution of one of our simulations. So we did this for 14 clusters. And you see that this is a coma-like cluster forming at the center of this cosmic filamentary web. There are two smaller structures forming two. And you can clearly see that, yeah, that this very filamentary and sort of point-like structure of structures forming. This shows the mass-weighted temperature in our simulations. You can see that inside this large galaxy cluster, temperatures of the order of 10 to the 8 Kelvin form. And as you grow, as you go outside, the temperatures decrease, the sound speed decreases, because shocks have not had yet basically realized this gas, because you do not look at a collapse structure. So how does this gas get heated? By means of structural formation shock waves, and this shows you basically a snapshot of the shocks that dissipate energy at this instant in time. That's actually a two-dimensional scale. So if you look just at the color, blue means this is a strong shock, yellow means this is a weak shock. And you can see that inside of collapse structures, there are only weak shocks occurring. And it's not surprising, because the sound speed inside a galaxy cluster is rather high, and it's almost impossible to actually sort of make a shock to be strong there. And as the sound speed actually decreases, a shock can actually get quite strong up to Mach numbers of 10 or 100, depending, you know, how far you get out there. The brightness here of each pixel shows the amount of energy that's being dissipated. And it's just the opposite. Most of the energy is being dissipated inside collapse structures, and there's less and less energy being dissipated outside there. Just basically the energy flux through the shock surface is maximized if there is a lot of mass sitting there. So that's a very good question, because this is actually the shock distribution weighted by the amount of energy that is being dissipated in the shocks. I know this in my simulation, right? I mean, that's basically, if I do have a shock, then entropy is being generated at these shocks, and random motions are being and ordered motion is being randomized, basically, and this is what we call temperature. So if I now, instead of weighting this distribution with the amount of energy is being dissipated, if I weigh this with the injected cosmic ray distribution, I get a very different picture. But before that, I would like to actually sort of make a recap of the Fermi process that actually accelerates cosmic rays. So how do we accelerate cosmic rays? What are the conditions for this? We first need a collisionless shockwave. Second, we need magnetic fields to confine energetic particles. We need plasma waves to scatter these particles, and particle diffusion basically, that the particles diffuse upstream. And we need suprathermal particles to start with this process. How does this work? First, our suprathermal particles diffuse upstream across the shockwave. Each shockwave crossing energizes its particles through momentum transfer at magnetic fields, plasma waves. And the momentum increases exponentially with the number of shock crossings. At the same time, we are losing an exponential number of particles with each shock crossing. And if you work this out, you will get a power law distribution of cosmic rays. Okay? So we put a very simple model there in our code. So this shows the post-shock Maxwellian distribution that is being heated by the shock. And depending on the shock strength, we inject the amount of cosmic rays. So that's the standard description of the test particle theory Fermi. There's a weak shock that is not very efficient in accelerating particles. You inject a steep population. There's a strong shock. The shock is very efficient in accelerating high-energy particles, basically. And the total amount of energy that is being transferred into this cosmic ray population is much higher. In our simple model, we have parameterized this because this is so far a complete unknown, and we would like to hope to measure these kind of functions in the future using the non-thermal emission from clusters. So at very high Mach numbers, so Mach numbers goes the left side, and this is the cosmic ray energy injection efficiency. At very high Mach numbers, your shock acceleration saturates at some point, and you inject up to, say, 50% of the total amount that you have available into cosmic rays. This might also be a little bit lower. And as you go to weaker shocks, the efficiency drops until you basically hit a sound wave that is not at all efficient accelerating cosmic rays. So we do not know the exact shape of these functions, but I believe that the functional, the cross-functional behavior should be universal and should be something, you know, what I put down here. All right. So going back to this Mach number distribution, how do you think is this now being changed if we now weight this by the amount of cosmic rays that are being injected? Any clues? So I just told you that weak shocks are not very efficient in accelerating particles. That means all these bright regions should be basically blinded out, right? So you only see basically the stronger shocks in projection that are basically sitting in front or behind the galaxy cluster. If we only look at the high energy cosmic rays, this is even sort of amplified, this effect, and you only see basically this very filamentary strong shock sitting in the warm, hot intergalactic medium here. Yes? That's a very good question, and the short answer is that's a subject to current research. there's indication, actually, from looking at supernova remnants, that shocks itself are able to actually bootstrap their way up and actually amplify magnetic fields at the same time where they are basically accelerating higher and higher energy cosmic rays. But the exact plasma physics going on there is not very well understood. It depends on a lot of plasma instabilities that sort of go on there. And so there is some indication. This is true. That's a good question. But what sort of Anatoly Spitkovsky has been able to show so far, that a shock is able to generate a magnetic field from nothing, basically, due to so-called instability. So in principle, it shouldn't depend. And actually, the amount of magnetic field that you need in order to confine particles is only nanogauss and slightly below. So the energetics is very, very simple to achieve. So, but again, this, I agree. I mean, part of this story might actually be modified. But now let's go actually and ask, if we now inject these cosmic rays, we follow their evolution through cosmic history, and this is what we end up. So that's the cosmic ray pressure distribution in our simulation at a redshift of zero. And you see that's very peaked, right? It doesn't look at all like the very patchy distribution that I sort of had that accelerates cosmic rays at this instant of time. What this tells us is that current shocks are not very efficient in actually building up the cosmic ray population that we find in a cluster today. And it's very simple because shocks that are actually happening inside a galaxy are weak. They're not very efficient, obviously. So I can turn this around and ask, what is actually the amount of cosmic ray pressure relative to the gas? And this is what we actually care here, because we want to actually measure the thermal pressure, and we want to know how this is biased by any presence of a non-thermal component. And this is shown here. So yellow means that there is basically a cosmic ray pressure that dominates the total pressure. Blue means the cosmic ray pressure is 1% relative to that of the thermal pressure. And interesting enough, if you basically go from the warm hot intergalactic medium outside into the galaxy cluster, the relative cosmic ray pressure actually decreases. Okay? Let's. Good point. Let's zoom in. Each of these yellow points is a galaxy, so to say. That's what Daisuke basically talked about. He had less galaxies because these galaxies, or these sort of these dense gas balls in our simulations, some of them represent a real galaxy, some actually represent gas that has been stripped off But since we do not in our simulations have the sufficient resolution to resolve all the instabilities that should basically resolve these gas balls, they will expand, come into pressure equilibrium, and stay there. They do not emit X-rays because they are cold, but they are quite dense, and that basically means they are dense. The thermal cooling time is really is something like 10 to the 8 years compared to the cosmic ray cooling time, which is a Hubble time. You basically sort of accumulate cosmic rays until basically you are in equipartition with the thermal gas. That's not unphysical. That's what we observe in our galaxy. So in our galaxy, we observe that the cosmic ray pressure is equal to the thermal pressure, equal to the magnetic pressure. So part of this is actually captured by our simulations here. They're very cold. So part of this is, I guess, a part of this is actually because we do not have sufficient resolution to resolve for them. I think part of them, half, maybe two-thirds, are unphysical because they're not resolved. And I guess this is partly because we just don't have the sufficient resolution to do this. Part of this is real, and yes, maybe they are actually affecting the overall emissivity, but if there is a strong point source, they're being masked out anyway. So I know that basically AGN or some point sources are being masked out by all these processes, and people that derive average smooth profiles are not affected by this issue. But yeah, any unresolved populations might actually have an important impact here. So can we understand it theoretically? The answer is yes. This shows the phase space, the relative cosmic ray pressure, is a function of gas density. So here is basically are the void regions. So this is the region where your cosmic rays are being very effectively injected because the shocks are very strong. And you see that the relative cosmic ray pressure actually saturates here. As you actually go inside the Link collapse structure, the relative cosmic ray pressure decreases simply as a function of the gas density to the 1/3. This is due to the soft equation of state of cosmic rays. So if you inject into this Lagrange blob of gas that is being affected with the flow, cosmic rays at an equal pressure, and you at the body compress this gas blob, the cosmic ray pressure increases at a slower rate than the thermal pressure does. And relative to the thermal pressure, you have basically the cosmic rays start to be subdominant. Except for the dense parts in our galaxy, in the very central part of the galaxy cluster, CD galaxy, this is where the thermal cooling time becomes actually much shorter than the Hubble time, which is the cosmic ray cooling time. And effectively, your thermal gas actually acts isothermally. And you basically, your cosmic rays shoot up here until you hit the star formation threshold, where you convert gas into stars. So in short, cosmic rays are being adiabatically transported into a galaxy cluster, and they're being subdominant, have a subdominant pressure contribution simply because of this adiabatic transport effect. So this is the main effect to understand the cosmic ray pressure in galaxy clusters. How does this affect the Sunyaev-Seldovich effect? So we observe the line of sight integral of the thermal electron pressure in my simulation. So that's basically a large merging galaxy cluster. And this is the Compton Y parameter of this galaxy cluster. On the right-hand side, you see a small cool core cluster, 10 to the 14 solar masses. If you take now the difference map of the simulations that actually injected cosmic rays and one that did not inject cosmic rays, you get this following figure. And you can see that this is quite inhomogeneous, the difference. So part of it is because this is a chaotic system, and you don't basically match the exact gas flows from a simulation to simulation. But you can see that there are large variations in the center. If you, however, integrate up the total Compton Y parameter, the total difference amounts only to -1.6% in this case, or -1% in this case for a cooling core cluster. And here, you get a systematic increase of the central Compton Y parameter to cosmic ray feedback due to the soft equation of state of cosmic rays there. All right. How does this affect cosmological parameter estimation? Okay, so very simple, what happens here? So first of all, if we actually run a non-radiated simulation and an adiabatic simulation, we get the following scaling relation. And if we sort of switch on star formation and cooling, you actually convert gas into stars, and the total Compton Y parameter decreases at a given mass. If you now have actually a flux-limited survey, your effective mass threshold of clusters you can detect is actually increasing, and you detect less clusters due to this simple baryonic radiative physics. And this is the main effect, basically, by talking about how radiative processes and cluster physical processes affect the Sunyaev-Seldovich effect. Here you can see an actual measurement for scaling relations by 14 galaxy clusters. Blue are non-radiative simulations. Red are radiative simulations. And you can see that the normalization drops. However, the slope is unchanged and resembles exactly the predictions of the self-similar scaling. You can see, I'm not sure if you are able to see this, but there are yellow and actually green points. And they are basically different models of cosmic ray injection. One actually we inject only cosmic rays and flux formation shocks, and one we additionally inject cosmic rays and supernova remnants. But if you basically look at the difference plot in our simulations with cosmic rays minus the one without cosmic rays, you can see that for each given system, there's a negative bias, but only of the order of a few percent, 3 or 4%. So that's not a big issue here if you want to actually derive cosmological parameters. At least, according, if you compare this to other issues there that we face and that we probably have not been able to sort of properly resolve so far, like the cooling the central galaxy, etc. Yes. I did not include AGN so far here. So that's basically. Oh, sorry. Oh. Anyhow, so. Yes. On the right-hand side, you see the central Compton Y parameter. First of all, you notice that there's a big scatter. And second of all, you can see that there is actually a positive bias and quite large bias, up to 40% due to cosmic ray feedback. So the lesson you have to draw from this is you do have to go out to quite large radii to minimize this effect if you want to actually do cluster cosmology to be on the safe side. So, okay, so individually, this is actually a bias low 6-7%. But if you sort of look at the average, how much the scaling rate is being changed, this is 1-2%. This is basically on a statistical basis.
I don't get that. If the typical thing is down that much,
so that's something like your typical thing if you draw basically. I mean, I fitted the scaling relation, and I did not find, if I include basically the model no cosmic rays compared to the model that includes cosmic rays, the amplitude is by slow by 2%, and the slope is also marginally changed. So, I mean, effectively, this amounts and sort of comes up with this, but you know. And I should say, basically, I put in the maximum injection efficiency that actually I could think of. So to some extent, this is an upper limit on the amount of cosmic rays that I can inject at a given shock. So if this is lower, then the pressure contribution is also lower. At the same time, I did not account for cosmic rays bubbling out of AGN. So that's something that basically, in addition, could bias it. Especially at high redshifts, if you inject that cosmic rays from AGN that are being transported along, that's something that we have to study and we will study in the near future. Okay?
So why
does
it net biased high by
40%? Okay, so this, I basically showed you that this is specifically in cool core systems where you have this systematic bias. And so first of all, the cosmic rays and soft equation of state.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
You can keep going if you want.
I'm fine. And basically it means we actually have to reach a higher density. With a high density in order to actually counteract rotational pressure, and that increases the Compton Y parameter. Because it does not, it basically cancels out the effect that the temperature is reduced, actually. Okay. So, just quickly quantifying this, this is basically the relative cosmic ray pressure in my clusters of the order of 2-4%.
is a function of cluster mass. If I were to construct, if we were to actually observe the combined or the Smirnov-Sandwich effect from cosmic rays as well as gas, if I basically construct a general constant y, that is the volume integral over the total pressure, or thermal plus cosmic ray pressure, I can basically plot this quantity and relate it to a simulation that did not have cosmic rays. And you can see basically now this bias got away, and I don't have any systematic bias anymore, showing that this effect I showed you is indeed coming from the own cosmic rays there. Okay? All right, how does this affect cosmological parameters? Well, we all know that the number density of massive clusters is exponentially sensitive to the amplitude of the initial Gaussian fluctuations, sigma 8. You can now increase the number density per redshift by lowering the effective mass threshold of your survey, or by increasing sigma 8 or omega m respectively. So there's a degeneracy of cosmological parameters with respect to cluster physics. So in other words, this is the NDZ. This is basically number distribution in a universe with low sigma 8 and a high mass threshold. You can now increase the number by lowering this mass threshold or by increasing sigma 8. And that's exactly the problem that we are facing here. Okay, so Schuber-Rahn actually, based on this scaling relation that I showed you before, Schuber-Rahn many self-calibration Monte Carlo Markov chains, and this is his result here. Let's concentrate on the lower left-hand side. This is the parameter space sigma 8 omega meter, and color-coded is the amplitude of my scaling relations. So I showed you I have a low normalization in my simulations that actually have that account for radiative physics. So these live up here, these models. If I basically switch off cooling and star formation, I increase my normalization. And in order to reproduce the numbers, I basically have to decrease my sigma 8 or, yeah, my sigma 8 basically. This is the along the degeneracy direction of this banana here. So if you do now self-calibration, you have to marginalize over all these possible amplitudes in your scaling relation. It means your resulting error ellipse is pretty large, right? If you, however, were to believe some model that somebody told you, then you basically can basically cut out certain regions where it lies. That reduces typically your errors at the expense that you might get biased if your model that somebody told you is wrong.
Sorry, can you just repeat? What was A and what was gamma?
So A is the amplitude of the scaling relation. Uh-huh. And gamma is basically the additional redshift evolution of the scaling relation. So, but this is, I guess, for this purpose, we can talk later. Okay, so, and in fact, this bias is approximately the 1% level going from non-radiative to putting a wrong Bayesian prior on our non-radiative model if the true universe actually includes cooling and star formation. This was actually done for an SPT-like survey with a minimum flux of 5 millijansky and 4,000 square degree fields, assuming a WMF 5-year cosmology. Okay. Hydrostatic masses. Very similar, important, and very intimately related to the total Compton-Y parameter. Again, this is the equation here. And the total pressure is the thermal pressure plus the sum of all non-thermal pressures. So what I plot here is now the mass difference of my hydrostatic masses minus the true mass divided by the true mass. So if I account for all non-thermal pressure, which I don't, I would get basically zero. Any negative bias here implies that I have a missing form of pressure. So what you see is actually there's solid lines, there are dotted lines. These are the corresponding models of where include or exclude cosmic rays. So the solid line is including cosmic rays, the dotted line is excluding cosmic rays. And the main thing you should take away is that there's not a lot of difference here. So you're not terribly biased. In fact, at the very least, there is some bias due to cosmic rays, but overall, it's of the order of 10%, similar values that DICE defines. And
you increase your mass bias if you actually go outside RVR. There's one very particular thing that actually we do not agree, that our SPH simulations do not agree with the predictions of AMR simulations. So if you go towards a galaxy cluster in the center, we see some systematic offset here due to turbulence. So that's actually, yes.
Oh, is this bias dependent on a function of cluster mass at all? Is it better for less bias for more massive clusters, for instance?
I have to admit, not this is pretty much independent, basically. I look at this. So in fact, I see same behavior in this last data that you find. If you look only at the unrelaxed systems, you do find actually a larger contribution there. But yeah, that's basically what we find. But you see that there's a huge spread here. You know, like from cluster to cluster. This is basically what the error bars indicate here.
Just one sigma.
One sigma.
And this is Gaussian grays? Gaussian grays in bulk motion or just bulk motion?
I do not correct for any turbulence. So any offset is the sum of non-sphericity, bulk motions, turbulence.
But not yet Gaussian grays. I mean, it says Gaussian gray at the top. That's why.
Yes, in fact. So if you should compare the dotted to the solid lines.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So that's the cost of
rate. Back to the 2-4%.
Yes, exactly. Again, there's not a big effect, and that's at least good for classical cosmology, right? I mean, that saves us. In fact, adiabatic transfer saves us here.
Do you have an error on the mean profile? What's the error on the mean?
This is the cluster-to-cluster scatter. I did not compute the error on the mean.
How many clusters are there?
40. It's down by a square root of 14, but I wanted to sort of the true scatter because that's something that you basically, find. So how does this come about, this central mismatch of hydrostatic masses in AMR versus SPH simulation? I will not spend a lot of time, but just quickly, there's been a recent nice paper by Mitchell et al. Looking at this in great detail, running flash simulations and gadget simulations, and you see without cooling, very simple non-radiated physics, and you see that AMR simulations develop a much larger entropy core compared to SPH simulations. In other words, SPH simulations contain much more random motions that is not being dissipated compared to AMR simulations. So that's basically an observation. This is a fact in simulations. The question is, how does this come about? So it could be either come from difference in gravity solvers, from the Galilean non-invariance of the mesh cones, from pre-shocking in the SPA range due to the artificial viscosity, or to a difference in the amount of mixing in SPH and mesh cones. And I don't have time to go into this, but it all does conclude here that it's most likely the last possibility. And you see here, this is basically the projected entropy map during a core collision, and it suggests that the different treatment of vorticity simulations accounts for this mismatch here. This shows the SPH simulations, and it shows a lot of vorticity being generated, this merger that is dissipating entropy and hence rising the central entropy level. What is the true answer? We don't know. However, one, and that might not be the important thing to take away, but one thing that actually this paper points out is that SPH simulations are able to reproduce long-lived spiral X-ray structures as an SPH code, and you do not see these features in AMR calculations, at least not in their simulation. So suggesting that either the true intraclustal medium is more viscous or that SPH provides a better way sort of to model the intraclustal medium. But this might not be the final answer. I'm just saying that both possibilities might be right, and this is basically just showing that, in fact, the amount of mixing that is, or the amount of non-mixing in SPH codes versus the amount of a lot of mixing in AMR codes might be, in fact, one of the prime reasons for this mismatch. I don't have time to look at this, but in fact, there are well-paid physicists and specific laboratories that exactly study this problem. What these people do, they actually set up experiments. And I'm just looking, just focus on this part. This is density structure of a so-called gas curtain, where you basically have a weak shock wave running over a dense blob, and density, velocity, and vorticity, and you see many more substructures that the experiment finds compared to the grid simulations. But again, this is just to touch on this, that these people actually
I have a lot of money available and a lot of resources, and they sort of face the same problems that we do in a cluster physics. So that's just something very peculiar to Schrödinger. And we won't solve this. Oh, it's not an easy problem to solve. That's fair to say, I think, really. Okay, the take-home messages from this part. The SZ scaling relation is affected by cooling and star formation. The slope is weakly modified, but the amplitude, why not, is reduced by up to 30%. The answer depends on our ability to accurately model the metal cooling, star formation, feedback, etc. Cosmic rays from shocks affect the slope only very weakly and modify the amplitude only by 2 or 4%. The large scatter in the central Compton white parameter is actually important. Therefore, you have to go out quite large radii in order to actually be not affected by the core processes that actually happen to be happen in a core. And one way out would be hybrid self-calibration, where you have weak simulation bias to actually have slightly good uncertainties in your cosmological parameters. So in the remaining few minutes of my talk, let me just basically go to the future of high-resolution Sunyaev sandwich observations. What can it tell us, the Sunyaev sandwich effect, about the cooling flow problem? Again, we've seen these pictures before, all these bubbles and clusters. There they are. They're filled with radio emission. And if you actually, if you're doing a minimum energy argument, you get at a number of energy density cosmic wave electrons that is only a tenth of the surrounding energy density. So you're missing a factor of 10 that basically sustains the pressure in these valves. At the same time, you have no idea actually how this jet looks like. Are they basically powered by protons? Are they powered by Poynting flux, etc.? There is still a big theoretical uncertainty. So I'm suggesting now a new observation strategy that is needed to elucidate the properties of the interaction and to understand the detailed plasma physics. So the idea is the following. Looking at these bubbles, X-ray is not the right thing to do because the luminosity is proportional, or the sort of the emissivity is proportional to the number density squared times the square root of the temperature. So that means you're not very susceptible to dilute bubbles that are very possibly very hot filling. The right thing to do is actually image them with this Sunyaev sandwich effect that is directly sensitive to the thermal electron pressure, because it measures directly the missing quantity pressure and provides the possibility of detecting bubbles actually further out. And the third point, the relativistic Sunyaev sandwich effect is actually sensitive to the trans-relativistic bubble fittings. So I'm going to actually talk about this. So what is the Sunyaev sandwich effect? We all know this, I believe. So there's a relative change in flux density due to the thermal Sunyaev sandwich effect, the kinetic one, and the relativistic one. So what is the constant of proportionality here? I think not everybody knows this. It's basically the Thomson optical depth to cosmic ray electrons. And what does it do? If you have the well-known thermal Sunyaev sandwich effect, and you basically make a population of electrons that Thomson upscatter seem to be hotter and hotter, you basically reduce this bump here, and you redistribute the electrons towards higher energies, the hotter you make your electron population. In the limit where you have actually ultra-high energy cosmic ray electrons, you completely remove all of the CMB photons at microwave frequencies and re-emit them or shift them basically up to high hard X-ray gamma ray energies. Okay, so what did we do now? We basically cut out these bubbles in a beta profile given by X-ray observations. We put down an analytic model that represents this procedure, and this is our prediction. This is how a core of the ABEL 2052 should look like if you actually image it with this Sunyaev sandwich effect high angular resolution compared to the X-ray emission there. This is how the Perseus cluster should look like.
If the filling of these bubbles is highly relativistic, or if a proton component dominates the pressure. If not, you will not see any contrast, a difference in contrast. The units are, oh, that's a good question. I had the units here. I don't, again? I believe it's my first or second, but I can look it up. So I have many chances. So anyway, I mean, it is feasible. So we did the calculation for GBT. You need about 10 hours or so in Perseus, but that's not a good source. In this cluster, you needed about 30 hours to actually detect the decrement. All right. So I told you, if the filling is just hot, a little bit hotter electrons, you will not see any contrast difference, and you basically do not see the bubbles near set. If, however, the filling is more relativistic, these bubbles basically come about. And depending on the amount of kinetic set effect this cluster actually has, these are the lines for different relative velocities of the cluster relative to the CMB rest frame. And a very nice thing is actually to look at this effect at the null, actually, at 217 gigahertz, where the thermal synergy effect is negative. Here you actually see a large effect. And you basically reverse the signature of this. So future high-resolution photometry of synergy synergy effect will possibly be able to sort of look at these bubbles and sort of elucidate, or sort of unveil the composition of these bubbles, and possibly sort of try to help us understand how the cooling flow problem is being solved, or at least provides us the boundary conditions to solve it. Okay, so let me wrap up this talk by flashing up a few slides about simulations that Deborah Zijaki did, where we actually now inject cosmic rays in these AGN bubbles. So this is an isolated cluster. This is a run without cosmic rays. So you purely distribute the thermal energy in these bubbles and let it go. This is where you basically put the cosmic ray energy in and just watch what happens. One thing, this mixes basically, and the effect is very quickly gone. If you put cosmic rays in, this effect is much larger because you basically, and by the way, these are basically mass with the temperature plots. And you can clearly see that the cold temperature is really, the cosmic ray pressure fills in this cold temperature here. And this is basically showing that putting cosmic rays into these bubbles, which we believe are in these bubbles, provides a much larger effect and is important because it changes the time scales on this, which the heating actually affects the cores of galaxy clusters. The coherence and the maximum cluster centric distance reach are affected by the presence of cosmic rays. Yeah, that's basically said. So, again, about ripples, and if Fabian makes a big deal about its ripples, this is again the X-ray surface brightness of a cluster, a little bit like a galaxy cluster. This is the uncharged mask image, where you just look at the difference in the X-rays, and you do see actually some weak shockwave popping up here. Similar to what he finds in Perseus. So at least some features we are able to reproduce some features of observations, so that's clearly one way towards the right direction. What about temperature profiles, and what about gas profiles? And that's the last thing I'm going to talk about. First of all, we are able to cure the overcooling problem. So what I've showed you in the first part was this black profile, where this temperature profile just drops like crazy in the very central part because it's just unstable to cooling and forms stars like crazy. If you now include AGN feedback, you are able to stabilize this. However, if you just have a thermal energy, you are able to stabilize it at the expense of a flat central temperature profile. If you now include the energy into a cosmic ray population, then your temperature profile actually decreases at the same level that is observed in the nearby galaxy clusters. So, and the last thing, gas mass fractions. So yes, we are able to solve the problem of the overcooling, and the amount of variance that is locked up into stars drops actually to a level that is now observed in galaxy clusters using AGN feedback, and pretty much independent on what you put in there. So if you put in cosmic rays or thermal energy. And that's where I'm going to stop. Well. yes.
So coffee-grated reagent is one promising solution to the old cooling problem. For the first time, we've been able to show temperature profiles and gas fractions in cosmological simulations that are in agreement with observations, and that successfully reproduce observational features such as X-ray ripples and bubble morphologies. And at the same time, I'm proposing high-resolution set observations to elucidate the dynamical component of bubbles, which is hopefully an important boundary condition to solve the cooling flow problem. And I'd like to stop by mentioning this will be a line of research that is not going to be solved easily and will keep us busy for quite some time. And it will be have an interesting interplay of asset observation and simulations that provide a great promise for understanding clusters and, to some degree, cosmology. Thank you very much. Yes.
Some delta. I'd actually had units on it. So keep going. So
Lajansky's just for our.
Yeah. So, but then what was the other thing that was on? So it goes up and then it dips.
Oh, which one are you referring to?
On the left.
The left one?
What is the other signal that's not the bubble? Is that all the bubble?
So that's basically the thermal pressure. This is the flux decrement there. Actually, the positive flux decrement, yeah, at 144 gigahertz, right? If you have basically a filling of cosmic-grade protons that do not actually upscatter CMB photons, then you basically have a missing decrement.
But then that's labeled as different V gas.
So this is basically now, this is now on top that you basically have the kinetics and absolute effect, and this contrast might be smaller or larger, depending on the cluster setting. Yeah, that's it's a 10% effect. That's
like
not
really micro. That's a big signal.
Of course.
So the kinetics SD is bigger than thermal SD?
No, the difference here is basically the kinetics. So that's 10% basically.
Zero is far down.
Yes. Yes.
It's not. Nice.
More questions? Other questions? So, I wanted to ask something, but I don't know.
It's a long day.
Okay, it's a long day, and the future, the other days will be shorter. It gets incrementally shorter. But let's thank all the speakers, but